Right, we're in Mark chapter 7 this morning. We're coming down toward the end of the chapter. Verse 24 is where we're going to start. Actually, we're going to back up a little bit to verse number 20. I wanted to go through the list of these sins that Jesus mentions here. But in our last lesson, we were talking about the teaching of Jesus in this section having to do with the fact that the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders, their idea about their traditions and their washing of hands and doing all of those things as a means of cleansing themselves spiritually and finding forgiveness in that way, that it was flawed. Now, those were part of the law of Moses, or at least there were commandments from the law of Moses that had to do with physical purification, but they were only meant to teach the importance of purity of spirit. And what the Pharisees had done by emphasizing their traditions and their doctrines and their opinions was to create a system of ritualism where as long as you did certain acts or went through certain works, they felt you were justified. And ultimately it came back to being descendants of Abraham and circumcision and those kinds of things that God just owed them salvation. And so they were focused on the outward things instead of the inward. And the Old Testament was not designed to do that. Though there was an outward show, it was also teaching about the heart. And that's found throughout, you know, the law of Moses. And Jesus emphasizes that by stating that it's not what goes into a man, but what comes out of him that defiles him. And so he reminds us that all of the sinful actions that we do start in the heart. It all starts on the inside. It starts with our minds. So he says in verse 20, that which cometh out of the man, that defileth the man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed. And then he gives this list. So Mark 7, verse 21, he says, evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. And so he emphasizes that it starts again in the heart and then proceeds outwardly. So let's just look at the list really quickly here, and that's going to lead us into the miracle that starts in verse 24. So you have evil thoughts, which is just what it sounds like. It starts with thinking things that are evil or vile or corrupt or worthless without any value. And so that's kind of the root of all the others, thoughts that are not in harmony with God's will. And then you have adulteries, which of course is a sexual relationship with someone who is married with someone who is not their spouse. Fornication is the broader term, which is any kind of illicit sexual relationship. So outside the bond of marriage, husband and wife, anything else is fornication. And so both of those start in the heart. And Jesus has taught that, and he taught it in the Sermon on the Mount, that the Pharisees were very strong and strict in condemning adultery and fornication, the outward act. But Jesus said if you have lust in your heart toward a woman, you've already committed fornication with her in your heart. And so the thought was sinful, and that's what produced the action. So to eventually commit those sins, it starts with the thinking in the mind. So we have to guard our minds and guard our hearts from those things. Then he mentions murders, which of course is, again, just what it sounds like, taking a life illegitimately. But that's connected to thefts, which is stealing from someone else, of course. And then covetousness, which the Bible tells us is idolatry. But this is a sense of greediness, of wanting what someone else has, and then acting upon it. And so sometimes when we read covetousness, we just think of the inner attitude of greed. But covetousness involves putting that greed into action. Because Jesus is talking here about things that men do. And he's emphasizing that it starts with the heart, but it shows itself in action. So covetousness is having greed or a lust or a desire for what others have, and then acting upon that to acquire those things by whatever means necessary. So stealing is one of those things, and you know, all the other corrupt ways that men go about making money and so forth. Then you have the word wickedness. And this word is a word that it's a word that refers to plots, and it's kind of the idea of entrapment. And so the devil is good at putting the bait out in front of us, right? So he puts the things in front of us that will entice us. And as long as we don't dwell on those things or think about it or let it take root in our minds, we won't take the bait and get caught in the trap. But when we do, when we let the thought linger in our minds, you know, James tells us that it starts with the thought, with the lust, that brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. So the devil tempts, he puts the desire before us, and if we dwell on it, then what comes out of that is wickedness. And the idea of this word is that we do something that is wrong, but we've actually fallen into the devil's plot and trap. And so while we've done something wicked, we end up getting caught in it. But again, it starts in the heart. Then there's deceit, which of course is being dishonest and lying to others. And this word is also connected to the idea of trickery or bait. And so you can put wickedness and deceit together, because when the devil puts the temptation before us, the bait sets the trap for us, he always does it with a lie. It's never the truth, because the devil doesn't tell the truth. He's a liar from the beginning, the father of it. So what he puts before us is deceptive, intending to trap us. And so deceit is when we listen to that lie and we commit ourselves to it and we act. And then we, whether knowingly or not, we become a tool for putting that same bait in front of others and leading them into wickedness. Lasciviousness, again, is the idea of lust, uncontrolled or unbridled lust. Licentiousness is another word for it. So again, it's the desire in the heart that we begin to act out upon. And this word is the idea of, again, in whatever way possible. So to become so overwhelmed with lust that we will fulfill it any way that we can. And that's any kind of lust, you know, like covetousness and those things. But it takes it to another degree and another level. And then he talks about an evil eye. And this is a word. The word evil is the idea of hurtful. It's wishing harm upon others, and it's something that you can see in the eye. It's not some kind of magical thing where you can cast a spell on someone, you know, like the evil eye. But the words here have the indication of you wish harm on someone else. And so as you look at them and as you look at situations and circumstances, you're trying to find a way to carry out that harm. And so your eye is only thinking about evil toward others, how to bring them down, how to hurt them, to hurt their name or their reputation or, you know, any of those things. Then blasphemy, of course, is just what it is, vilifying something that is holy, so speaking against God or against holy things. But again, it starts in the heart. A lack of love for that which is holy leads us to speak evil of it. Then, of course, there's pride, which is not having a proper evaluation of oneself, so being haughty, thinking more of ourselves than we should, not putting God in his proper place and ourselves in submission to him, and then, of course, acting upon that in the way that we live. And then there's foolishness, which is kind of a general term for recklessness, not using wisdom, thinking man's thoughts instead of God's thoughts. And so we go about our lives doing what we think is wise or smart. And in fact, it's foolish. It's unwise because we're not following God and his will. And Jesus says that all these evil things come from within and defile the man. So their focus was on washing your hands and washing your dishes and making sure, you know, when you ate that everything was clean. And if you did that, then you wouldn't be defiled. And Jesus says those things have nothing to do with defiling a person. There may have been a ritual aspect to it under the law of Moses, but what defiles a man is what's in his heart, in his mind, not what's in his stomach. And so he's trying to make that distinction clear to these Pharisees who have come all the way from Jerusalem up to the north of Galilee in order to try to entrap Jesus, because they believe that they are righteous and that Jesus is a false teacher and that he's wrong, and they want to find something against him. So their hearts are wrong, even though they think they're doing all the right actions. Jesus, of course, was right in heart and also doing the right actions, but they wouldn't accept his right actions because they were in contrast with their traditions. So they're trying to accuse him, and he's showing the difference in, you know, the whole philosophy of their way of thinking and what the Bible actually taught. Now, with that in mind and with that distinction between the Pharisees and Jesus, we come to verse 24, and there's an interesting miracle that takes place here. And it's one that sometimes causes confusion for people, but I hope we can look at it and understand it in the context here of what's taking place. So the Bible says, "From thence he arose and went into the borders of Tyre and Sidon and entered into an house, and would have no man know it, but he could not be hid. For a certain woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by nation, and she besought him that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter. But Jesus said unto her, Let the children first be filled, for it is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it unto the dogs. And she answered and said unto him, Yes, Lord, yet the dogs under the table eat of the children's crumbs. And he said unto her, For this saying, go thy way, the devil is gone out of thy daughter. And when she was come to her house, she found the devil gone out and her daughter laid upon the bed." So sometimes when we read this miracle, people will accuse Jesus of being cruel or being mean toward this woman for comparing her to a dog and those kinds of things. And that was obviously how the Jews thought about the Gentiles, and they kind of want to put Jesus in that same category. But when we understand the context here and what Jesus is actually doing and what he's talking about, he wasn't being cruel, but he was testing this woman's faith. So there are a couple things we need to notice here. The first thing I want us to do is real quick go back to Matthew's account of this miracle in Matthew chapter 15, starting in verse 21, just to notice a couple of details that Matthew gives us that are not in Mark. So Matthew 15, 21, "Then Jesus went thence and departed into the coast of Tyre and Sidon." And by the way, you notice the word coasts there in verse 21. Over in Mark's account, it said borders. And that's what the word coast actually means. When we think of coast, we think of like a sea coast. And Tyre and Sidon were on the Mediterranean Sea, so they did have a coast. But this word is just the word for borders. So he left... He was in Jewish territory, and then he went north of the Sea of Galilee into Gentile territory, and now he goes even further into Gentile territory, even out of the land of Palestine, or Canaan, however you want to call it, out of that country into other countries with Tyre and Sidon. So the opposition among the Jews was growing, and Jesus steps away, not because he's afraid of them, but because it's not time yet for him to be crucified. But he goes to the Gentiles, and this is an important part of his ministry, that Jesus, though he was sent to the Jews, he wasn't only sent to the Jews, and he also went to the Gentiles. So he's in Tyre and Sidon. Verse 22 says, "Behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coast, and cried unto him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she crieth after us. But he answered and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then came she and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, It is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. And she said, Truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. So if you notice in Matthew's account, he adds the detail that she was a woman of Canaan. So Mark tells us that she was a Greek, which is the word that means a Gentile. She wasn't a Jew. He tells us that she was a Syrophoenician, giving us a location for where she was born. But Matthew tells us that she was a Canaanite. So there's a lot of history with the Canaanites and the children of Israel, going all the way back to when God brought them into the promised land. They were commanded to drive out the Canaanites. But the important connection here, I think, is to another Canaanite way back in the Old Testament who hid the spies when they came into the land of Canaan at the first. And that, of course, is Rahab. And so when the spies came in to spy out Jericho, Rahab took them in and hid them so they would be spared from being captured and being put to death. And, of course, as a result, when Jericho was destroyed, she and her family were spared. They stayed where they were supposed to. She put the scarlet cord from her window, and so her household wasn't destroyed. But here's the fascinating thing about Rahab. Rahab, of course, was a Gentile. She wasn't a Jew. She was a harlot, meaning probably that she was a prostitute. But nevertheless, she, as she tells us, had heard about God through what happened to Egypt. So when God sent the 10 plagues on the Egyptians and then delivered the Israelites, parted the Red Sea and all of those miracles that took place, Rahab and her friends and neighbors had heard about this. Obviously, Egypt was the world power at that time, and God brought that entire empire down. So everybody had heard about what happened in Egypt. But Rahab is one of the few who, when she heard that, understood that the God who did that is the only true God. He defeated the gods of Egypt and all those who worshiped and served them. He clearly demonstrated and proved his power and his superiority over them. You know, there's a fascinating thing that's happening in our society today with the resurrection of the Egyptian gods and goddesses. And not just Egyptian, but Greek and Roman too. But they're just kind of descendants of the Egyptian gods and goddesses. But there's so much in our world today, in our movies and in our television and everything, that's bringing back or trying to bring back the Egyptian gods. And part of the reason is because, as crazy as it sounds to us, there are a lot of people in our world who never stopped worshiping those false gods under different names and under different systems. But the worship is the same and all of the depravity is the same, and it's still present in our world and sadly in a lot of the leadership of the world. And there's so much of this vile corruption that we don't see, but it's present, and it ties right back to those things. And when those people get in power, they think that by bringing these things back into the forefront, they're going to influence others to believe in those things and to follow it, and it increases their power and their influence. But God proved forever that the Egyptian gods are not gods. They have no power when he sent the 10 plagues. Every plague was an attack on one of the Egyptian gods or goddesses. And those gods could not defend themselves against the one true God because they weren't gods at all. They're from the mind of man. So God proved his power over them. Rahab heard about it, and she became a believer in God. So when the Israelites came into Jericho, here they found someone who was a Gentile who, you know, didn't know Abraham or any of those things, but she knew God. She knew the God of the Jews as the one true God because she understood what had happened in Egypt. So picture it this way. The Israelites who were in Egyptian bondage witnessed with their own eyes the 10 plagues. So they got to sit down at the table and eat the dinner. They saw the power of God in all of his strength and all of his majesty. And then they came out of Egypt, and you know, within a month they were at Mount Sinai, and then in 40 days they were building a golden calf and worshiping it, and that entire generation died in the wilderness except for two people. And here you have Rahab, who never saw a miracle, who didn't see the 10 plagues. She didn't witness all of these things. She just got the crumbs that fell from the table. Yet she had more faith in God than those Israelites who actually witnessed all of those things. And that's what the Syrophoenician woman is a connection to. She wasn't a Jew. She hadn't received the law of Moses. She didn't have all of the blessings that the Jews had received. She'd only gotten the crumbs that fell from the table. But she had more faith in Jesus than those who actually witnessed his miracles and who saw him do the powerful things that he did. And the reason they didn't believe in him was because his teaching didn't line up with their opinions and their views and their interpretation and those things. So they couldn't accept the miracles because they didn't like the doctrine. They didn't like the truth that Jesus was teaching. But here is a woman who hadn't seen the miracles. She'd only heard about them. Jesus had never been in her country before, never been in that territory. She'd only heard stories from afar. But when he came there, he wanted to do it in secret. But when she found out, there was no more secret that Jesus was there, because she did everything that she could to get to him. And then no matter what people did to try to keep her from him, she kept on pursuing him until she received what she asked for. In contrast, you have the Pharisees who traveled all the way from Jerusalem up to Galilee to see Jesus, not to hear his miracle or see his miracles or to hear his truth, but to try to find some way to discredit him. You have the Jews and the Pharisees who saw all those miracles of Jesus, but they weren't bringing people to him to be healed. Now, the common men were, but the leaders weren't. They were trying to undermine his miracles. He healed on the Sabbath day. You're not supposed to do that. He must not be from God. They saw the miracles and said he did it by the power of Beelzebub. So those who saw the miracles denied them and tried to undermine the one who performed them. And this woman, who hadn't seen the miracles, went to Jesus and did everything that she could to appeal to him to get help, not for herself, but for someone else, for her daughter. And that's why Jesus says about this woman that she has great faith. And he says that not only great is thy faith, but he says, be it unto thee even as thou wilt. He answered her request, her prayer, because she demonstrated her faith. And it's in line with the faith of Rahab and with those Gentiles throughout the Old Testament who came to believe in God, the one true and living God. And so it's teaching us a lesson about the fact that what the Pharisees and the Jewish leadership, their fundamental understanding of God was completely wrong. They had this idea of a national religion, right? God created the nation of Israel, right? That's true. It's correct. He promised to Abraham in Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3 that he would make of him a great nation. And he did that in Egypt. They came down 70 people, and God multiplied them into this great nation and brought them together in the crucible of their bondage and their slavery. So when they came out of Egypt, they were a nation. But they interpreted that to mean national salvation, that if you're born a Jew, then you're a part of God's chosen people. Therefore, you have a direct ticket to heaven. So it didn't matter how you lived or what you did or if your heart was pure. All that mattered was you had Abraham's blood and you kept the ritual of the law, because God loved Israel and he didn't love anybody else. And all of that was absolutely wrong. That was never what God intended. And the very fact that that generation that came out of Egypt, going to the promised land of Canaan, that every one of them died in the wilderness except for Joshua and Caleb, they were the only two to enter the promised land, should have proved to them forever that this was not a national salvation. It's individual salvation. It always has been. God deals with individuals and with their hearts and the actions of their lives, not about who your parents were or what nation you're born into. But the Jewish idea was that because we are Israelites, we are God's chosen people, and he loves us and he doesn't love anybody else. And so they hated the Gentiles. And what Jesus does in this miracle is to show that God is concerned about individuals. And if a Gentile woman who had never, seen a miracle that he performed, but if she had faith in him and demonstrated that faith by her actions, then she would receive the blessings. And if a Jewish person who did see the miracles and heard the teaching of Jesus but rejected him, didn't change their heart, then they would not receive the blessings. Salvation has always been individual and not collective, not national or anything like that. And so we need to remember that, I think, in two aspects. One, we often talk about, and pray for our country, and we want to be a Christian nation. The only way for this country to be a Christian nation is if the members of this country, the citizens of this country, are Christians, right? There's no national salvation. God doesn't create a Christian nation, and then everybody who is an American is a Christian. If we want Americans to be Christians, we have to convert them to Christ. And so instead of focusing on the politics and on trying to, you know, make a national religion, we need to be going out to our neighbors and friends and teaching them about Jesus so they can be Christians. And that's how you create a Christian community, a Christian state, a Christian nation, whatever it is, because it's always individual. And then when we create Christians, you know, people are converted to Christ, then they can become leaders in our nation and lead us in the right direction, as long as we, you know, support them and vote for them or whatever. But if we're not teaching the gospel and helping people to know God's will and making them Christians, then we're never going to be a Christian nation. And this idea that all I have to do is vote once every, you know, 4 years and hopefully the right person gets in and he's going to lead us back to Jesus, that's never going to happen. The way it happens is you and me as Christians doing our part and our duty in our world, making Christians by teaching the gospel. And that's always how it's worked with God. So it's not about a national salvation, it's individual salvation. And the second thing we need to learn from that and remember is that just because I say I'm a member of the Church of Christ doesn't guarantee my salvation. Just because I was baptized into Christ when I was a teenager or sometime during my life doesn't guarantee my salvation. Sometimes we develop this idea that salvation is only in the Church of Christ. And don't misunderstand, it is only in the Lord's church. There's no salvation outside of Christ. It's only found in his body. But just because I became a member of the Lord's church sometime in the past doesn't mean my ticket is punched to heaven. And that because I can claim that I was, you know, baptized, therefore, it doesn't matter how I live since then or how I think or what I do, because my membership is on the roll, you know, at a congregation, doesn't guarantee my salvation. And that's something that the Jews had a problem with, especially in Jesus' day, thinking that just because they were a part of this group, that guaranteed their salvation. But that wasn't true then, and it's not true today. It takes more than your name on a roll, you know, of a church here on the earth to be on the roll of God in heaven. It takes faithful Christian living. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life, Revelation 2:10. And so we need to be focused on our daily living and making sure our hearts are pure, trusting in God and obeying his will, because salvation is always on an individual basis. A couple other things about this miracle. I'll go back to, one more thing in Matthew's account. She called Jesus, thou son of David, which means she understood that Jesus was the Messiah. And that was something that even the Jewish leadership would not admit. They wouldn't call him the son of David, even though he was, and he was directly descended from Abraham and from David, you know, through Mary. They wouldn't admit that because they didn't want to follow that claim that he was the Messiah, the one they'd been waiting for, because he wasn't their idea of what the Messiah should be. But here's this Gentile woman, you know, way out of Palestine, who understands because of the miracles that he did, and understands apparently because she had some knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. And what a testimony it was against the Jewish leadership that this woman could see it and they refused to. Her heart was so honest that she accepted the evidence and admitted the truth, and their hearts were so hardened against him that they wouldn't admit it, even when he stood right in front of them and raised someone from the dead. They wouldn't admit that he was the Messiah. And so she's demonstrating what true faith looks like. I also wanted to mention that when Jesus says, let the children first be filled, he's, of course, talking about the fact that the gospel was to go first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. And that was God's plan, and he had his reasons for that, and we see it carried out into the book of Acts. But that didn't mean that the Gentiles were excluded or that God didn't love them or he'd never tried to include them. He always did. But then he says it's not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it under the dogs. And I think it's worth pointing out here that though the Jews referred to the Gentiles as dogs, they used a Greek word that referred to like wild animals, wild dogs. And the word that's used here for dog is actually the word for a puppy. It's the word for a house dog, you know, a dog you keep in your house and it's a little puppy. And so when he calls her a dog, he doesn't use that derogatory term that she's just, you know, a dirty dog, but he uses the word for her role in a sense in the household. So if this is a time of starvation and you have children and you have a dog, who gets the food first, right? Now, it's a dangerous thing to ask that question in our world today because there are a lot of people who would feed their dog before they feed their kids. But the answer is the children get the food first because they're children and they're human beings and they're not dogs. It drives me crazy when you see people out begging for money, right? And they're like starving and have this sign that we need food and whatever with their dog sitting beside them. And I'm like, if you have enough to take care of your dog, then you ought to be using that to take care of yourself. Give your dog to somebody else who can take care of it. And people get upset because everybody loves their dogs. But if it's a matter of starvation, I mean, we ought to have priorities here, right? So what Jesus says is, in the order of things, you feed the children first, and then she says, of course, the dogs get the crumbs from the table. And that's certainly true. But Jesus was talking about the gospel coming to the world, first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. Not that she was eliminated and not that the Gentiles were always going to get the crumbs, but eventually it was going to go to the whole world. But her faith was demonstrated by her humility and by how, you know, when the Lord didn't answer her and then the disciples tried to shut her up and tried to get rid of her, she kept coming back and she did so with humility and with worship. She bowed down and worshiped Jesus. She understood that nobody else could help her the way that he could. No one else could meet the need that she had other than Jesus. And that's ultimately the lesson from this miracle, that the reason the Pharisees rejected him was because they didn't think they needed him. They were self-righteous. Their sins were already taken care of because they were descendants of Abraham. And we have to learn that lesson, that if you and I truly understood our need for Jesus and how utterly dependent we are upon him for everything, especially for our salvation, there would be nothing in this world that could ever keep us from him. We would do whatever we had to, go through whatever we had to be where he is. Like Peter, we'd step out of the boat and walk on the water through the storm to get to him. Like this woman, we'd crawl on our knees like a dog begging for crumbs at the table if we understood our need of Jesus. Because without him, we are utterly lost and helpless and hopeless and doomed. But with him, we have everything that we need. And she recognized that, and no disciple and no insult and nothing was going to keep her from Christ. And today somebody says something that hurts our feelings and we get mad and quit the church and think we've made some kind of statement. We just don't understand our need of Jesus. It doesn't matter what people say. You're not going to turn me away from him because he's the one that I need. So I hope we learn that from this miracle. There's one more here at the end of the chapter when Jesus comes out of Tyre and Sidon, but we'll look at that one in our next lesson. We're out of time, so we'll stop here. Pick up in verse 31 in our next lesson.